From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For most people, it just doesn't compute. Imagine believing that one of your limbs, an arm, a leg, doesn't belong, that it's not supposed to be part of your body. It's a rare disorder called body integrity identity disorder. For some, it's a vague sense of something out of place. Others are very particular about the limb, even the part of the limb that shouldn't be there. In West Bountiful, Utah, there lives a woman afflicted with this condition, and today in the program, we're talking about it, about the history of it, how it works, and how people react. We're also premiering a short film about her as part of our new website, Video West. Her name is Chloe Jennings White, and she's trying to get surgery to paralyze her left leg. We invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a lot of questions that will come to you once you learn about Chloe Jennings White and her condition. She has body integrity identity disorder. It's extremely rare. It's this feeling that one of your limbs isn't supposed to be a part of your body. I'll let that settle in for a moment. It can be persistent, this feeling, that your leg or your arm doesn't belong with your body. There are stories of people trying desperate things to resolve this feeling. Some try amputation, self-mutilation. Chloe Jennings White hasn't tried any of that. The treatment she uses for dealing with this feeling is a wheelchair. She gets around at home and at work in a wheelchair. Jennings White says it's the way her brain is wired, this sense that she's not supposed to be able to walk. So she's trying to find a surgeon to paralyze her left leg. Today in the program, we're talking about body integrity identity disorder. We're talking about how it works. We're talking about how it feels. And we're going to get to your questions today. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I should mention we've produced a short film for our companion website, Video West, that explores body integrity identity disorder. And we'll give you more details about that as we go along. We're going to begin, though, with Michael First. Michael First is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. He's a research psychiatrist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and he's one of the only psychiatrists who's actually studied body integrity identity disorder, BIID. In fact, he actually gave the condition its name. We talked to him earlier today on the program, spoke to us, in fact, from a studio at Columbia University, and First says it was actually a journalist that drew his attention to the disorder.
Well, I became aware of this condition when I got a phone call from a producer for the BBC program Horizon. It was in the late 90s. And I got the phone call because I was the editor of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is published by the American Psychiatric Association. So I suspect they got the call first, and it was barred over to me. And this gentleman was explaining how they were doing a documentary following some individuals who wanted to become amputees.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know how the DSM would diagnose such individuals. And I told him I had never, ever heard of this phenomenon before, and I asked him to explain what it was like and what he knew about these people so I could have an idea of, you know, be able to hazard a guess as to how we would diagnose these people. And when he actually gave me the little bit of the history, he told me that the condition was called apotemnophilia, which is a Greek word which means love of being an amputee. It's basically suggesting these people were, at least the name would suggest that there was a sexual arousal component, that was the main motivation for wanting to be an amputee. But when he actually described the two individuals who were in the program, it was very clear that that wasn't what their motivation was. They were using phrases like they felt that they would become restored to their natural existence by becoming an amputee. So I was completely surprised about this, and I said, I gave him some You know, in the DSM, there's always a diagnosis for anything. So I told them to use some residual category for people who have concerns about their body. And I said, that was it. And I asked him to send me some more information about this because I was not aware that such a condition existed. And that really piqued my interest. So that's mm-hmm. how I really got started.
What made you sort of stick with the subject? I mean, it's intriguing as a disorder, I suppose. But you've spent a good amount of your work kind of exploring this or looking at it anyway.
Right. Well, there are two things. First of all, I mean, my interest was immediate, partly because usually when people talk about adding a new disorder or claiming a new disorder, it's usually something that happens normally that's taken to an extreme. Something like, you know, binge eating disorder is a good example. That's something that's just been added recently to the diagnostic manual. And, you know, the concept of binging, you know, we understand how people would binge. So if somebody binges too much and feels bad about it, that's a disorder. So most proposals for new disorders take something which is a relatively normal phenomenon that becomes extreme. This is so completely out of left field. The idea that someone would want to become disabled, it's usually everybody's nightmare to become disabled by accident. The idea that somebody would want that is so completely unusual, it really made me want to understand what was going on. What was the motivation? How did this get started? So it was a really uncharted territory that really pulled me in.
Mm. Let's explain a bit how it works. As you say, a person who has this condition believes that a limb essentially doesn't really belong as a part of their body.
That's right. Usually, this starts in childhood, so it's not something that somebody wakes up one day as an adult and decides that they should be an amputee.
Right.
It almost invariably starts very early in childhood, where a child, usually what they actually see is they'll see another amputee and realize that that's the way they should be, or someone who wants to be paraplegic, they'll see someone in a wheelchair, and they'll get this epiphany that, you know, I've always felt a little uncomfortable with my leg or uncomfortable with the idea that I walk. But actually, when I see people who actually don't have that, that's the way I should have been born. And they have this sort of aha moment. And from that moment on, they feel that that's the way they should be. And they feel uncomfortable with the fact that they can walk or with the fact that they have both legs. And it persists into adulthood. And it's a chronic sense of unease. It's a constant feeling of some level of suffering for those people who have this. They just feel like life is just never right.
You said they can be quite particular about all of this. I mean, they pinpoint not just the limb they believe is out of place, but a certain place on that limb.
Yeah, it's variable. I mean, well, I did this study where I've interviewed over 100 people with this condition. So one of the things that it became very clear was how the people's, while there's certain trends in common, there's a lot of variability. So there's certain people who can actually point to a spot on their thigh and say, this is where my thigh should end. And if I were to could get a surgeon to do the surgery, this is where I wanted to do the cut. There are other people who have just more of a vague sense that I just don't want, my left leg shouldn't be there and, you know, maybe should be above the knee, but I don't actually have an exact spot. So there's, you know, there's certain different, you know, kind of levels of precision. So some people are very precise and other people are less precise.
I know it's quite varied, but I understand the most common limb that is out of place for people who have this condition is the left leg?
Left lower, yeah. Left
yeah.
above the knee. And again, why this is true is hard to speculate. You know, part of the question is what actually causes this. I mean, if you a couple of explanations. I think there are certain people who favor a neurological explanation. And I think that based upon where the left leg is mapped onto, that may make it more likely. But another possibility is like why legs versus arms. If you can imagine that one way this gets started is a child sees an amputee, I think leg amputations are both more common and also more visible. If someone is an arm amputee, it's possible they could be wearing a shirt or something and hide it, where a leg amputation is much more obvious. So it may simply be exposure. There's more leg amputees around. So if what's going on is you see someone mm-hmm. at a very early age and that has a huge impact on you and you may want to choose the kind of amputation that you saw as a child, maybe it just simply reflects that you're more likely to see a leg amputee as a child than an arm amputee.
You've written about the history of the condition. Do we have any sense of when this was first recognized or when it was first documented?
Yeah, there's actually the first written up case was in 1977 That's where it got the name apotemnophilia. But right. going through retrospectively through the literature, someone actually found an article in French from the 1800s of an individual who went around trying to get surgeons at the time to do the amputation. And they don't have that much data about it, but it certainly sounds very suggestive that that may be the first reported case of this condition.
It's interesting, those initial ideas about this, that it was connected, it had to be kind of a sexual sort of disorder. Is there a sexual component to it, do you think?
Yeah, I think when I did my study and interviewed a lot of people, mostly men with this condition, I'd say roughly 60 to 70% reported some sexual component to it, that the idea of them being an amputee was very arousing. So it got the name simply because the first two cases presented to John Money at Johns Hopkins, who specializes in sexual deviations and also gender identity disorder. So he sort of seeing it through that lens, and those first two cases had a strong sexual component, and that's how that name stuck. But it was very clear that for most people, the sexual component, if it even exists, is minor. And the major issue has to do with the sense of identity, that their true identity is as a disabled person, and that's their main focus.
The woman we're going to meet later on in the program, Chloe Jennings White, used to be a man, went through gender reassignment surgery, had a sex change operation, I guess. Are they related, gender identity and this condition, do we know?
For people to understand, I often, when I try to explain this condition, which sounds so completely off the wall to most people, usually the way I try to start the explanation is use as an analogy gender identity disorder. So yeah. If you look at gender identity disorder, it's a very similar phenomenon, that an individual, usually at a very young age, believes that they should have been born the opposite sex and that their anatomy that they were born with is wrong, and that's why they want to get rid of it. And then they actually have the transition, and then they're much happier. This condition is very, very similar, in that at a young age, you have a child who feels that some part of their body weren't born the right way. And then when you actually, in those cases where people have actually had a surgical correction, in the same way that people with gender identity disorder feel much better, these people feel better too. So just from a parallel perspective, the disorders are actually very similar. So it raises an interesting question. Is there some deeper connection between the two? And when I did my study, I looked at, I interviewed 53 people with this desire to be an amputee. And in the interview, I asked each of them, did they ever have feelings that they were the wrong sex, or that they should have been the opposite sex? And 10% reported some feelings like that. Now, that sounds like maybe that's a small percentage, but if it was a coincidence, the actual prevalence of gender identity disorder in the population is less than 0.001%. Huh. So it's a much greater incidence of gender identity issues with people who have this, wanting to be an amputee or a paraplegic. So my hunch has always been that there may be some early function that we all, the normal function as a young child, that has to do with your sense of being right with the way your anatomy is, and that for certain people that's fluid and goes wrong. So if you imagine such a function exists, it would make sense that there'd be people that have both this and gender identity disorder, because whatever it is functionally that sets our sense of identity may be malfunctioning in these people.
You've said, if I get this right, Dr. First, that aside from this condition, for the most part, these people are fairly normal. I mean, you said at one point that you could spend an evening with most of them and not have any idea.
That's absolutely true. It seems so counterintuitive, because the idea of what they want seems so bizarre that you'd expect them to be bizarre people. And the vast majority of these people I've met, apart from this one circumscribed unusual aspect, are normal. They have families, they're professionals, they're very accomplished, except for this chronic sense that they're in the wrong body. And they usually, you can imagine, keep this a big secret, because it's it's completely not accepted by most people. And so they live kind of a secret life of thinking and fantasizing about having their disability, yet to everyone else they look like they're perfectly normal, and you would never know from talking to them that there was anything amiss.
I wanted to ask you about the way people react to this condition. We've encountered it ourselves already, just telling people about Chloe Jennings White. How are you sensing that people react? Because something that it really challenges even the most open-minded people, this is something you've said really doesn't compute. It's hard if, for example, paraplegic. It's unimaginable, even offensive, the idea that you would want in some way disable yourself. So I get a sense there's not a lot of empathy in some way for people who have a condition like this.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. There's an issue of both repulsion or just lack of, this is so weird, I can't compute. And then there's, for people who think they understand it, there's a lot of, a tremendous amount of lack of empathy. So, for example, I mean, one of the problems, unlike gender identity disorder, which is, originally when the idea of, men who wanted to be women, 100 years ago, that was considered pretty bizarre, but that's eventually become completely accepted.
Right.
This condition will never, I believe, have that level of acceptance because the idea of going from one normal state, male, to another normal state, female, is something that, even though that's a little strange, people could accept the idea of why you might want to be the opposite sex because that's normal. The idea of wanting to be something which is so generally accepted to be is, a terrible thing, like being disabled, that's extremely hard for people to imagine how that could ever happen. Now, for the people who have this, they experience the idea of paraplegia very different than the way you or I would. I mean, to us, it would be a tragedy to be hit by a car and end up being paraplegic. To them, the state of being paraplegic feels both natural, and I think there's almost a sense of going through life struggling and overcoming a disability as something that is a positive thing. They see disability as something that could be positive rather than the way most of us experience is negative. So when you see someone with this who wants it, a lot of people are just suspicious that they're, trying to get, the benefits of being disabled or that they're almost like making a mockery of, I think the people who are most angry about it are people who actually have the disability or have a family member who has experienced one of these disabilities. They just see the fact that somebody would want this is completely, unacceptable.
Have we been able to yet pin down exactly what is going on, if this is psychological, if this is brain wiring? There was a study that came out a few years ago, suggested the condition is linked to reduced activity in particular brain areas. You seemed not convinced, I think, when I was reading your reaction to that, not convinced entirely at the time. So how are you thinking about it now?
The way I view it now is like with most psychiatric conditions, we don't understand what the cause is. So this is certainly, and we have almost no data about this because it's so rare. Even right. Disorders which have been around for 100 years where there's been, thousands and thousands of papers, we still don't understand the cause. So, the brain and psychiatric disorders remain difficult to really figure out. But as far as this disorder is concerned, the best you could come up with is theories.
Yeah.
So the issue of is this a neurological condition that represents a brain dysfunction has been mostly pushed by neurologists, and they correctly point out that there's a part of the brain, the parietal lobe, that is sort of a body map. And it kind of makes sense logically that someone who wants to be an amputee who feels that their leg shouldn't be with them, maybe the problem is that the part of the body map that's the leg is missing, so that to them, that the correct map would be, not to have the leg. And they have done a limited number of brain studies with those individuals, and they do see some abnormality. And one possible explanation is that would be the cause, that somebody's born with a defective map, and that's how it presents. The problem with that kind of thing is, what's the direction of the cause and effect? If you spend your entire life feeling like your left leg shouldn't be there, and then somebody scans your brain as an adult, it's possible that, we all know that when the brain is very plastic, when someone has a stroke, they can regain their function because the brain can rewire itself. So it's very possible that what you're actually seeing is that part of the brain, due to maybe years of using it less or whatever, has rewired. So what you're actually seeing is the effect of this rather than the cause. So that gives me some pause. And the other problem is that it doesn't explain the paraplegic cases. I mean, that theory about the brain map only works for actually having a certain part of the body. And it also doesn't explain the fact that some people over their life shift the part of their body that they want to have amputated.
Wow.
Most people, it's stable, but there's at least 20 or 30% of the cases where there's some lack of stability. So this theory about the brain map doesn't explain those cases either. So my gut feeling is there probably are some people where the neurological explanation fits, but there are clearly people where it doesn't. So you need to come up with at least one other explanation for those people as well.
This is different from body dysmorphic disorder? This idea that your body is ugly or... You know what I mean?
Right. It's very different. The names of the disorders are unfortunately very similar, so there's always a little bit of confusion. But for somebody with body dysmorphic disorder, there's a sense that some part of their body is really ugly or defective. It's an appearance issue.
Yeah.
These people have no sense that there is anything wrong with the way the part of the body they want to have amputated looks. They're not embarrassed to show it. They don't think there's a sense of defectiveness. It's more of the functioning isn't right. So it really feels very different. When you actually see people with body dysmorphic disorder and people with this condition, it actually really, those people are very, very different.
I've heard various explanations. People say, look, it's wannabes or pretenders. They're looking for attention. Again, I guess it goes back to the fact that it seems incomprehensible, this kind of disorder, but that seems part of the reaction, is that this is just them sort of wanting attention what do you make of that?
I think, part of it is you have to, having, my own view of it, it's almost hard for me to get back into the mindset of someone, sort of aversion to the idea. I've been working with this now for so many years, and I've met these people, and for the vast majority of them, that's just simply not the motivation. If anything, they don't want attention. They just want to function as an amputee or a paraplegic and go on with their lives. The idea of how people react to it is not in any way the focus. So, to an outside person looking at it, you may, sort of assume that that's their motivation, but it just simply isn't. So I wouldn't say that there's not any person with this condition where attention is a component,
sure.
But the majority of them, attention is not. And this comes again from the study I did where I asked everybody, I came up with a questionnaire, and when I formed the questionnaire, I was kind of coming up with hypotheses that might explain it. And one of the hypotheses was that this was simply seeking attention. So part of the questionnaire focused on that. And the vast majority of people, it was pretty clear that attention seeking was not a major component at all.
The question then comes to, what do you do about this? What's the kind of treatment? I mean, beyond obviously surgery, which I want to get back to, but one of the techniques, for example, that you've suggested for our guest later on the program, Chloe Jennings White, was a wheelchair, because it seems like for her to get a wheelchair, settle into a wheelchair, because it seems like the condition is constantly on their mind. And maybe I gather that's a way of kind of distracting them, to get them to stop constantly thinking about it.
Well, I wouldn't say it's quite as a distraction. It's sort of a halfway measure. I mean, I think that my attitude, I'm a physician, and my goal is to reduce suffering. So, that anything that could be done that could make these people's lives better, to me, is justified. So for people who want to be amputees, there is actually, at least conceptually, an option for surgery, and there are surgeons in the past who have done the surgery. For people like Chloe, where their desire is to be paraplegic, there's no medical professional has ever been willing to actually make someone paraplegic.
Right.
You could say it's kind of hypocrisy, why amputation and not paraplegia, but for most doctors, paraplegia just seems to be so much more extreme. No one's willing to do it. So for people who have the variant of the condition where the focus is paraplegia, really the only thing you can do is to do something that allows them to at least simulate what life would be like as a paraplegic. So the wheelchair is a partial solution that many, if not most people with this version of the condition find helpful. It allows them to at least, as you say, I wouldn't say exactly as a distraction, but it sort of quells the sense of unease enough that they can function better. I'm sure the vast majority of these people would, if given the option, would actually want to become a true paraplegic surgically, but that's simply not available to them. So they sort of accept the wheelchair as a halfway measure.
So what do you say to a patient like Chloe, for example, who are searching out these options for, elective surgery, going outside of the United States going outside of sort of conventional Western medicine? It seems a lot of them are sort of looking all over the place.
Right.
Some of these people seem to be saying, medication, is not working. Therapy doesn't necessarily work. Yes, the wheelchair, I know Chloe has said, works for a while, but it's not, as you said, it's only only gets her part of the way there. So what do you say to them if they're searching out surgery? I mean, what can you say to them about that?
Well, it's a problem because it's frustrating for me, too, because I really don't have a good solution. I mean, the reality is that a surgery is not really available.
Yeah.
My big concern is that somebody would actually try to do something on their own to make themselves paraplegic. That happened with the amputation. The early cases, people would actually, there's a very famous case of a gentleman who staged a hunting accident and shot his leg off with a shotgun. And there have been a number of cases like that, and some of them have actually been fatal. However horrible that is, it's a lot more straightforward to create an amputation than to create paraplegia, because you could really kill yourself or make yourself much, much worse. So I really make it clear to these people, caution against, I know they're suffering, but do not try this on your own, because you're almost certainly going to end up either dead or in a much worse situation than you are now. So that's my first caution. And then the best I could say is, well, you do the wheelchair, and maybe in some future there'll be someone doing a research study or a surgeon who might be willing under controlled circumstances to do this, at least for the purpose of studying it, to make it better. I guess another problem with doing the paraplegia or making someone paraplegic, that's never actually happened. Nobody's actually been made paraplegic who wants this, who can then report that it was a good thing. With the amputation, there have been enough people who've actually had the amputation who say this has really improved my life. At least we have some track record that it's a successful procedure. At this point, you might say, well, if it works for amputation, it should work for paraplegia, but that's simply speculation. And certainly with every one of these cases, when you consider a surgical option, everyone's nightmare is that someone goes through the surgery and then when they wake up, they say, oh my God, I'm worse off. I regret this. That would be horrible. So that's what you really want to avoid at all costs.
Well, or if they don't say that right then, you mentioned that for some, the limb shifts. It changes to another part or another limb itself. And what if, in fact, then now once you've gone through this, some kind of surgery like that, it does shift?
Well, luckily, the cases that have been done so far, that hasn't happened. And the shifting usually happens earlier on. By the time someone gets to be an adult, it's usually stable. I mean, one, like with gender identity and sex reassignment surgery, when that became just started out, very clear standards were set up for who would qualify for the procedure. So the best you could do is to try to screen out people where there was at least some indication that it might not be a good idea. So somebody who had who came in and said, my history is my limb keeps shifting over, one side to another, that person probably would be a very poor candidate for even considering this. So I think you can do the best you can to try to look for red flags of people where it seems likely not to be successful, but you never really know. It's all crapshoot. And, the real question that a lot of people come up is does the person have the right to do this, or should society protect them from this? And that's one of the big ethical debates about, having the surgery done. Do these people have the capacity to make this kind of informed decision, or is somehow this illness affecting their ability to make a clear-headed decision? And that's a big question.
Let me ask you this finally. I want to come back around to this question of trying to empathize, or at least in some way understand, people who have a disorder like this. Sounds like a lot of the ethical questions, a lot of the particulars, even neurological questions, are in some way still up in the air. What do you tell people? Do you just say, look, try to be understanding for the time being? We're trying to figure out how it works and what it means.
Yeah, I try to tell people to be patient, and unfortunately, when they kind of look back at me, and they often say, "Well, you're not the one suffering. It's easy for you to say this," and that's true. And the reality is, we have lots of incurable diseases in medicine, and in a sense, this is like that, in that we have things we can do to help relieve the suffering, but we don't have a definitive solution at this point. Hopefully, over time, when more data is available, we'll have a better idea. But ultimately, I think that these people are sort of at least now doomed to have at least some level of ongoing suffering, because we can't do anything definitive right now.
It's Michael First. He's a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. His research includes treatment of body integrity identity disorder. He joined us today from New York City. I should mention today in the program we're premiering a short film on our companion website, Video West, that explores body integrity identity disorder through the story of Chloe Jennings White, who has the condition. That web address is videowest.kuer.org. Chloe Jennings White is going to join us when we get back from a break. We hope you will too. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a condition that just might challenge even the most open-minded of some of you. Chloe Jennings White is our guest today. She's a professional chemist, originally from England, has a PhD from Cambridge, these days lives in West Bountiful, and she wants to be paralyzed. She wants her left leg to be paralyzed. It's a rare condition that we're talking about today called body integrity identity disorder. And we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, probably lots of questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Chloe Jennings White, I mentioned her PhD in chemistry from Cambridge University. She also has a lifelong fascination with the field of pyrotechnics, holds a number of patents in fireworks. She works as a chemist here in Salt Lake City, and she's joining us in the studio. And Chloe Jennings White, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's an honor to be invited here.
I want you to begin, if you would, with the story that you've told me before about being young, and your parents would be away from the house, and you would take the opportunity to bandage your legs. Would you start with that story?
Yes. I found more or less by accident that by bandaging my legs, the anxiety that I felt from BIID was significantly ameliorated. And one of the interesting things I noticed was that if I bandaged just the right leg alone, it didn't feel right. Mm. And if I bandaged the left leg, that felt really good. It was actually best of all to bandage both legs, but certainly there was always been a preference for the left leg.
Dr. First talks about there being this kind of trigger sometimes. That someone will see an amputee or they'll see someone in a wheelchair. Do you remember anything like that?
Yes, I was listening to Dr. First's description and it really struck a chord with me when he said it's a matter of recognition of, oh, yeah, that's what I need. And I remember from about 4 years old on, if ever I saw anybody who was wearing leg braces, I would think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to have. And that's always stuck with me. And those are my earliest memories of it. And it's not anything about the particular character of the person that made me want to be like them. It was just a recognition that that was how I was supposed to be.
This idea of how I'm supposed to be, that's something that that sort of gets at it, right? I mean, that's how you seem to explain it, that it's just something's not right.
Yes, it's hard to find any sort of rational explanation for it. You, as Dr. First said, anything that's based on any advantage that could come from being disabled, that just doesn't explain it at all. It's a question of this is who you are supposed to be. And that's what society happens to label as disabled in this particular case.
So how does it feel? One of the things that Dr. First talked about is this idea that for a lot of people who have this disorder, that it's intense. It can be distracting. It seems like it's something that's persistent, always on your mind almost. Is that right?
It is extraordinarily intense, yes. It became more intense for me after I had a minor spinal cord injury in 2006 because after that I had constant reminders that I was part way towards where I wanted to be. And so it was pretty much impossible to forget about it. And I think a big improvement came when it was Dr. First himself who suggested to me that I might try a wheelchair. And like he said, that it's not so much a distraction, but it's certainly true that I think about BIAD much less while I'm in a wheelchair, and then I can focus more on the rest of my life.
And that's the idea, just to sort of something to, I don't want to, again, it's not a distraction, but, and it's not just to keep your mind off of it, right?
Or you know, the strange thing is, the more I use a wheelchair, the more I forget that I'm using a wheelchair. And it just becomes a natural part of who I am. And so I think about it less and less. But the less I think about it, the more effective it seems to be in mitigating the BIAD.
Dr. First says that people can be very particular about all of this. We talked about, you know, some really pinpoint a part on their particular limb. This is the part. He mentions the left leg, which is, in fact, seems like for you the offending limb, right?
That's the most important part of my body, yes, is the left leg. You know, ideally, I would have complete paraplegia, but because of this asymmetry that I feel, it seems to me that I would actually be pretty happy if it were just the left leg that was paralyzed.
The question that I thought about is it's not as though – one of the things I was thinking of, I'm going to ask her if she's drawn to paralysis. Is there an appeal of paralysis? But it's funny for someone you've talked about being fairly – well, quite active. I think even in a wheelchair you're quite active. You go on these wheelchair hikes. You're learning how to ski. So it's not like you like the feeling of being immobile. So what is it?
Right. And I don't think BIID is about wanting to be disabled. I think that's probably the most common misperception that people have about it, is that it's able-bodied people wanting to be disabled. And I think that's where a lot of the criticism about it comes from. Mm. But that's an erroneous premise. And it's more specific to needing a particular impairment rather than being disabled. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of people with disabilities, as I do, they frequently don't see themselves as being disabled. That's what the rest of society calls them.
You mentioned the ski accident a few years ago. Take me through that experience, if you will, because you then experienced some partial paralysis in your left leg, and you've described it as kind of this wake-up call from the universe.
Yes, that's right. I don't want to get too mystical about it, but I can interpret it as a reminder. It's just like, hey, you don't forget about this. This is your destiny. This is who you're supposed to be. And so when I had that partial paralysis and all the other usual kind of things that go along with a spinal cord injury, the loss of sensation, muscle spasms, incontinence, back pain, they're all reminders. It's like, okay, let's do this.
Was it forgive this question, was it all, I mean, it was, you were in a lot of pain, but was there any pleasure associated with the fact that you felt some paralysis now?
Well, not initially. For the first 3 months or so, I really couldn't think about anything else but the pain. Having even a relatively minor spinal cord injury does produce a great deal of pain. And it was only about 3 months into it that I started to realize that, oh, some of these effects, that they're not going away. And so, for example, I didn't actually realize that I had loss of sensation in my left leg probably until about 6 months afterwards, because I had nerve pain such that a slight touch to my left leg was registered as pain. And it wasn't until after that had disappeared that I realized that I was then experiencing no sensation at all when I touched my left leg. And, you know, and I loved it. I still love it.
Seemed right.
Yes.
This question comes up. You've also been through a car accident, an automobile accident. We had a skiing accident. And I guess the question is your brain, is there some subconscious part of you conspiring with your body, do you think, to kind of get rid of the offending limb, to paralyze your left leg?
As my psychotherapist likes to say, psychology is complicated. Okay. And so I'm not sure I can answer that with a simple yes or no. I can't rule it out, but I don't actively seek out things to make me paralyzed. I try to be careful in everything I do. I don't, I'm a very safe driver. I don't want to get in a car crash or any of these things that I know do make some people paraplegic.
There's nothing reckless about you necessarily? Nothing subconsciously reckless about you?
Well, I can't deny that absolutely because, how much of my subconscious am I aware of? I don't know.
But it gets to this bigger question, which, comes up. Are these people of the right mind? Can they, and we'll get to this question of the surgery as we go, but are they, the question is there's some psychosis. Is this mental illness? Are they under delusion? I mean, Dr. First says not really. At least his sense of it is that, again, you could have dinner with them and not sense anything unless they told you the story.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, one of the diagnostic criteria of BAID is that you're not delusional about it. You know exactly what your functioning of your body is. You know exactly how disabled you are and are not from the physical point of view, and you don't have a delusion that if you're in some kind of accident, you will necessarily end up with paraplegia. You're completely aware that you may get a brain injury or all sorts of things can happen, and so there's really no sense of being out of it, being crazy. One is in full possession of one's rational faculties.
Here's an email or a comment rather from George, who writes from Layton. He talks about a movie, a feature film called Quid Pro Quo, premiered at Sundance a couple of years ago, and in it he explains the film's protagonist is this radio talk show host who was confined to a wheelchair because of a traffic accident. And George talks about how the film depicts and explores this subculture of people who want to be paraplegic. But the film sort of depicts these people, he says, as fakes, quote unquote. He wants to get your impression of that, this idea that there are these people out there who are wannabes or who are faking it or trying to get attention or, you know what I mean? I mean, because there is this impression, I guess, out there.
Yes, and I have seen the movie, and I enjoyed the movie, but I took it more at a metaphorical level rather than a realistic depiction of people with BAID. I don't feel a fake in any way because it would be faking for me to walk around as if nothing was wrong with me. That would be the faking. And also, I'm completely honest with anybody that asks me about this. I don't pretend to be paraplegic. I've never told anybody that I'm paraplegic. If somebody asks why I use a wheelchair, I will come right out and tell them about the BAID. And I also have physical reasons from the spinal cord injury and also fibromyalgia for using a wheelchair. And I explain all of this, so no, there's nothing fake about it.
Here's a comment from Howard, who writes from Salt Lake City. He says, a couple of months ago, he mentioned a show that we had here on Radio West about someone who had Tourette's syndrome. He's written a book about working in a library. And Howard writes, he likened needing to twitch and make noises and grunts to what it feels like when you need to sneeze. Howard writes, you just need to get it out of your system to feel normal, like how you want to feel. Is that anything, he writes, like this BIID?
You know, that's a very good question. And one of the things I've noticed in terms of I have a lot of friends who have BIID, and the majority of them actually already have substantial disabilities. And these include cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis, spina bifida, and also Tourette's syndrome. Hmm. And there seems to be, in my perception, some kind of synergism between already having some kind of disability and having that intensify one's feelings of BIID. I'm not sure if I answered the question.
I think you did. I mean, it also, another question that came up in our conversation with Dr. First was the suggestion that there's a sexual component to this. We should mention you were born intersex. You've had gender reassignment surgery. And Dr. First seems to think there's some kind of connection there. You're not as convinced that there's a relationship, or are you?
Yeah, in terms of my personal experience, there is no sexual turn-on for me in terms of either thinking of myself as being disabled or other people being disabled.
Does that bother you? Is that an offensive idea, that you're getting it's a sexual turn-on?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of offensive to me whenever people make assumptions about who I am rather than asking who I am. Now, I do know that some people are turned on by disability. I get hundreds of people writing to me because I'm so public about this. The majority of them are people with disabilities being very positive about it. But there is a segment of what are called devotees, and they like to interact with me because I'm in a wheelchair.
Huh. Creepy?
Well, a very few of them, I would say, are creepy.
Yeah.
In my experience, probably 90% of them, at least, are just very nice people.
Hmm. Kristen writes, she says, I've had a brief experience with feeling like a limb did not belong to me. One night after days of sleep deprivation, I awoke and realized to my horror and that my body map ended just below my left shoulder. My left arm felt foreign. Which is interesting. I mean, this was sort of a temporary experience, it sounds like, for Kristen. And she writes, I wonder if any physicians have tried body integrity disorder with mirror therapy. You know, if there's other kinds. You've heard of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, that has been used for phantom limb pain that some amputees get.
But this is different.
I'm not sure anybody's tried it. I'm not quite sure how you would set up that experiment. Yeah, I think it's worth trying a lot of different things.
I wonder the idea of trying different things. You've heard the lengths that people go.
Oh, absolutely.
To remedy it, you know, chainsaws, self-mutilation, shooting themselves with guns, trying to self-amputate, those kinds of things. Do you feel like I know you don't ever feel quite that desperate. You've never talked about feeling that different. But do you ever feel like something has got to give at some point?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think trying to paralyze oneself is just too risky in terms of...
Have you ever thought about it?
Oh, yeah. I've given thought to it. And I just don't see a way to do it that would give a successful outcome that would be sufficiently well designed to do that. I think it's going to take a medical surgery to do what I want.
And what is that? What's the surgery?
Well, as Dr. Furr said, that surgery for transection of the spinal cord itself is not available. What is available in other countries is surgeons willing to do transection of the femoral and sciatic nerves, which go to the legs. And since I have an asymmetry in my BIAD, I would like to have those nerves cut to my left leg, so that my left leg would be completely paralyzed.
You know, in reading about this, one doctor, a man from Stanford, Dr. Spiegel, David Spiegel, said that he didn't agree with the idea of doing the surgery. He said it wouldn't necessarily do away with the condition. He was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "I don't think the answer is fitting in with the obsession or the delusion." How do you react to that kind of impression?
Well, I have a number of friends with BIID who have the amputation variant of that, and they have successfully managed to get their legs amputated. And it's a wonderful treatment for them. I mean, the look on their faces.
They feel cured?
Yeah, they feel very, very happy about it and cured, yes.
And so you're convinced that if you could have this done to you, that you could rid yourself of that persistent sense, that feeling.
Oh, absolutely. I'm extremely confident about that.
I guess the question is, do you realize what that means? You know, since we're running out of time here, this question of, you know, for people who are, you say you have friends who are paraplegics, but to them, it's unimaginable, to many anyway, to some, it's unimaginable that someone would want to disable themselves in any way. You already are in some way, but still it seems unimaginable. Are you sure you realize what the implications of this would be? You sound so convinced.
Well, yes, I've had half a century to think about this. I've done a lot of research online. I've had friends with disabilities for decades, and most of my time every day is talking with people with disabilities, and hundreds of people have written to me, and they explain to me all about the physical consequences and the psychological consequences. And in terms of just getting my left leg paralyzed, it would mean very little change to my current lifestyle, because I already wear a left leg brace in any case, whether I'm in a wheelchair or not. So, yeah, I'm pretty confident that I know what's involved. I've already had things like pressure sores because of the injury that I do have. So I know how to do mirror checks and those kind of things to look after.
You're ready.
Yeah. Yep.
Clay Jennings-White works as a chemist here in Salt Lake City, lives in West Bountiful. Today, I should mention, we're premiering a short film on our companion website, Video West, that explores BIID and the story of Clay Jennings-White. And Dr. White, thank you very much.
Thank you
for being with us. You can continue the conversation by going to our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.